Not counselor, anybody who's providing counseling. So that's a licensed social worker. That's a therapist. That's a psychologist. That's a psychiatrist. That's an MD. That's literally anybody who is providing you counseling for mental health symptomology. So you have to report literally anything. Like if a pilot goes and one of their loved ones pass away, right? And they're just dealing, they want to go talk to somebody about grief, right? And deal with a grief counselor. That's instantly reported on box 19 on the 8500. So what do pilots do in that case? They don't do that, right? They just don't see a mental health professional. They don't see a counselor. They don't see a therapist.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm Tate Duryea, here with Ryan Gibson. How's everybody doing?
Tate, I'm excited to talk about today's guest. I mean, we're talking about all the heavy items here.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is an opportunity to talk about blurry thing that none of us understand, which is aeromedical, HIMSS, you know, the fact that pilots can't go and get therapy. It's really, really good stuff. And there's some incredibly actionable takeaways in there.
Yeah, what I love too is, you know, we dive into not just mental health issues and HIMSS, but you know, what happens if you get a DUI? What happens if you get pulled over? And in the end, you know, this is a financial podcast. So we talk about sort of the mechanics behind aviation law, what jobs there are, how pilots can moonlight in different positions in that. So we kind of expose some more things that maybe you thought, like never thought of that you can even do in the aviation industry, and a little bit more than just the mental health stuff. So without further ado, let's get to the show.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure. How are you?
Excellent. You know, I want to, you know, I was reading up a little bit about your background. You said you were doing some hurricane chasing. I definitely want to get into that. But yeah, give us a little background on who you are, where you come from.
I've had an interesting flying career. I think I've been kind of all over the board.
Yeah. What, you know, kind of talk to us about that. I mean, just kind of give us a little bit about your flying background, you know, how you got into working for, you know, as the director of aviation, is it Ramos Law?
Ramos Law. Yeah. So I've been in aviation my whole life, but I'm kind of one of those odd ducks where nobody in my family was a pilot or in aviation. So started as a lineman at 13 at a private airport, obviously, as a 13-year-old driving the jet truck. But started flying before I could drive, and then have just been looking for weird and unique ways to continue flying. So was as soon as I was able to, I started competing in aerobatics for a while. My first airplane was a Citabria. So now I fly a Stearman 450 and been air showing since 2012. And then I'm a Part 91 guy through and through, so never was 135, never was 121. Fly a handful of jets on the side for people, for 91 families. But then I also do some government work as well. So flew a Lear 35, still flying the Lear 35 since 2018. And it's a contract company, and it contracts to NASA and NCAR and NOAA. And we basically weather hunt. So a bunch of instruments that hang off the bottom of it, literally took that airplane around the world from Denver to Denver, the long way, just continuing to head east. We were in the desert for a while with that airplane, so flying through some haboobs and some weather out there. We were in the South China Sea for a while as part of NASA's Camp 2X and typhoons. Been with that airplane in Houston trying to hunt hurricanes, and then all through the Midwest in Tornado Alley with it as well, just flying through convective storms.
What's the worst turbulence you've hit, and what kind of storm was it?
So it was actually, I know exactly which one it was.
So you can remember it, huh?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We had a person of prominence in the back. It was during NASA's Camp 2X, and we hit turbulence coming off of a typhoon just south of Japan. And we hit 7,000 up, 7,000 down pretty quick. And it took the interior wall of the Learjet off. And then full rubber jungle, all that good stuff. So yeah, that was the worst. And unfortunately that individual in the back of prominence was not fully strapped in, like, you know, had the seatbelt on, but loose, and went into the ceiling and got a little injury on the, you know, hitting his head on the lights. So,
wow.
By the way, rubber jungle for those listening is when all the oxygen masks deploy from the ceiling. So it's a little chaotic when that happens. Okay, Joe. So every question that a pilot always gets answered is, have you ever been afraid, or what, your scary flight? Were you afraid during that time, or were you like,
I've been through so much stuff with that Lear. You know, we've had it painted now twice. we've been through engines. that thing is just such a tank. It honestly is just a tank of an airplane. So I've never been super terrified in that. It's always done exactly what we asked. And even in the times when it's not doing what we ask, it'll get you home. So
Well, you know, I know you're also really involved in community service. You have that Memorial Scholarship Fund for the Colorado Soccer Association, which is very cool. Thanks for doing that. I'm sure the kids, love that. But, you know, some of the things that we want to get into on the show is just your experience in aviation law.
Yeah.
We're actually going to change things up a little bit on today's show and go into pilot mental health issues or the issues surrounding mental health and some of the things in the industry. And we're going to get deep into that today. We're really going to kind of expose that. And I think that's why we're really excited to bring you on. But, you know, we're also going to look at kind of your business and sort of how to make money in aviation law. And, you know, because this is a financial podcast, but sure, we're going to mix a lot of things in here, you know, cool weather flying stories. And that's super interesting with aviation law, with pilot mental health. We're going to like bust everything open today. So Tate, you want to take us away on kind of the first question?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Joe, can we kick things off by just giving us the context of how you got into law in the first place, why you chose the specific practice that you do, what called you to that, and give us some context on what that looks like.
Yeah. So I owned a flight school for just under 5 years. And during that time, I saw students that lost medicals, that were unable to get medicals. We had an aircraft that had a mechanical that we ended up having to put in a field, and that ended up going to litigation. And there was just a lot. It turned out there was a lot of legal surrounding my life, and I was not in it. And I eventually got tired of paying attorneys. I got tired of dealing with the FAA directly without having the backing of being able to say I was an attorney. And at that time, my wife was already in law school. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to law school. So went and joined her in law school with the idea that I was just going to go into aviation, not really knowing what that meant at that time. I was thinking actually that I was going to do transactions, went to school in Kansas, and I was going to try and do the law behind buying and selling jets. And then while I was clerking, we started getting a bunch of medical issues coming through at the firm that I was working for. And I got thrown into those cases and immediately realized, you know, oh my gosh, there's a bigger calling here, right? There's a bigger calling to help this industry because nobody's advocating for these pilots. So immediately got out of law school with that focus, doing Part 91 drivers and helping them get their medical. And then slowly but surely started doing 135 drivers, started doing 121 drivers. The union started calling, trying to represent pilots and make sure that their certificates were protected. So I kind of got forced into that industry just purely on necessity and need from the industry.
And you work with HIMSS and cardiovascular issues, so there's a lot to dive into here. Ryan, I know you're dying to jump in. What do you got?
Well, I just want to lay it out there. I mean, let's just talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is, you know, pilot mental health. You know, I'm going to play a clip from a recent event. We can, if you're not familiar with what's going on in the industry, the recent Alaska flight, German Wings, countless things that happened in the industry that have really just kind of been detrimental to everybody, right? And we're going to dive into that, but without further ado.
Over the weekend, disturbing new details from Flight 9525's mangled cockpit voice recorder, published by German newspaper Bild.
The CVR transcript was leaked way too early in the investigation.
Tonight, there is a major development in that tragedy in the Alps. Investigators now revealing what they have learned about that co-pilot. The chilling internet searches they found on his computer, searching suicide and cockpit doors.
So obviously very chilling what happened. And, you know, as a pilot, there's a box 19 on the 8500-8, right? And it basically says, if you are seeing a counselor, a therapist, a social worker, an MD, a PhD, whatever it might be with regard to mental health concerns, that could be an issue. Like, you have to report it. Talk about that and give us your insights on that, Joe.
Yeah, so before diving right into 19, I'll tell you, so I actually started my career by putting Part 91 pilots into the HIMSS program. So I dealt with a lot of substance abuse, a lot of substance dependence, and that was kind of my focus at the time. And then eventually I started realizing through more and more cases countrywide that really our problem is not kind of the stereotypical drunk pilot, right? That's really not the problem in the industry. The problem is self-medicating in the industry. So pilots turn to alcohol because alcohol is permissible, right? You can use it. 8 hours bottle to throttle, 0.04, you're allowed to use it. The FAA doesn't slap you for using it unless you use it to an excess or you have a problem, right? So I found more and more of the pilots that I was dealing with the HIMSS program were not really alcoholics. They were dealing with a mental health issue and they were self-medicating with alcohol. And the reason really is box 18 and box 19 of the 8500-8. Box 19 is just so tight. As you said, Ryan, it's so tight in that, you know, generally it's have you seen it's you have to list all your medical providers from the last 3 years. And, you know, typically we think of, you know, general MDs like a primary care physician, or maybe you got like a dermatologist or a dentist or, an eye doctor or something like that you would list. But if you go into the instructions on box 19, it says that you also have to list anybody who is providing counseling, not counselor, anybody who's providing counseling. So that's a licensed social worker. That's a therapist. That's a counselor. That's a psychologist. That's a psychiatrist. That's an MD. That's literally anybody who is providing you counseling for mental health symptomology. So you have to report literally anything. Like if a pilot goes and one of their loved ones pass away, right? And they're just dealing, they want to go talk to somebody about grief, right? And deal with a grief counselor. That's instantly reported on the box 19 on the 8500. So what do pilots do in that case? They don't do that, right? They just don't see a mental health professional. They don't see a counselor. They don't see a therapist. And they let those conditions, we know through the DSM and through the industry clinically, that those conditions compound, right? There's only so much a person can take, right? What starts out as grief could end up in major depressive disorder, right? A year down the road. And now all of a sudden we're facing, like what you just played, we're facing a German Wings episode, right? It's been eye-opening over the latter part of the last decade, just kind of seeing that transition away from, you know, really, really diving into the why. Why do pilots deal with mental health? How do they deal with mental health? How do they not deal with mental health and just choose to drink? It's been kind of a crazy past 10 years.
And you know, the thing is that I think people need to realize is like, we are people before we're pilots.
Yeah.
And you know, just because you have a great record and you get your ratings and you get your flying hours and you get hired by a great airline, we're still people.
Yeah.
And people require, you know, these types of things as services to be good people, right? And so,
yeah,
you know, it is kind of a squeaky clean right. Job, right? A requirement. You can't have any, you know, the DUI is a kiss, could be a kiss of death, you know, depending on the airline, any blemishes in your background, any potential drug use and things like that. And these are all good things to protect the industry and they're well-intentioned.
Sure.
But we have to be realistic with people being people before they're pilots. You know, it's a huge thing. So go ahead, Tate.
Well, Joe, you know, I mean, we all kind of know that the FAA is 30, 40 years behind the industry. You know, I was listening to a little bit of you talking about their antiquated cardiology system where somebody gets, you know, and they want to look at it. They don't even have the expertise versus, you know, cutting edge, you know, medical centers know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I think this follows the same lines where the FAA is just behind the industry. Do you think there's any hope over the next decade of them sort of catching up, or do we need to talk about how to just skirt the issue and get around it?
I have more hope now than I've ever had. So this has kind of been over the past 10 years, I felt like, you know, the boy who cried wolf, you know, like just by myself, just yelling, saying, hey, this is a problem. This is a problem. This is a problem. And falling on deaf ears, right? Just no response at all until all of a sudden, you know, we have, you know, after obviously German Wings was a while ago, but we have the Horizon pilot, right, who tried to pull the T-handles on the Alaskan flight. We have the student in University of North Dakota who took his life. And in his suicide note, he referenced the medical standards of the FAA and not being able to seek treatment. Most recently, we have that student who rented an airplane down in Texas, right, and flew it off the reservation and told ATC he was done and drove it into the ground, right? We've had a lot of episodes and events here recently in a very short period that all of a sudden Congress and the Senate are saying, hey, what's going on? The NTSB is saying, what's going on? Which is forcing the FAA to say, uh-oh, right? And so now we have the FAA doing the ART committee, right? They're modernizing the mental health standards, policies, regulations throughout. Honestly, they're not only doing mental health, they're supposedly doing everything, right? They're supposed to modernize the entire clinical realm and determine what really is aeromedically significant. And we're expecting they're required to produce some sort of recommendation or some sort of guidance at the end of March. So I will tell you, I am more optimistic now than I ever have been. If you were to ask me a year ago what we're supposed to do, I would have said there's no hope. I mean, there's no hope.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, just for those that are not unfamiliar with the ARC process. So part one specifically talks about the Aviation Rulemaking Committee that gets assembled when you're changing aviation law. And it's something that I was actually pretty involved in for a long time in Capitol Hill, where if there's a problem in the industry, there can be comments submitted to the FAA, usually through a site called regulations.gov. And if the FAA deems it necessary, they can put together an aviation rulemaking committee. It's actually a beautiful process. It brings the entire industry together, the unions, the airline pilots, the representative of family members involved in airline accidents. All key stakeholders are brought together and they deliberate for weeks, for months, for years sometimes on making good policy, reviewing what has been done in the past, and coming up with great recommendations. And they make those recommendations to the FAA, and the FAA gets briefed by the ARC and takes those recommendations into consideration for writing laws. And it's actually, I think it's a beautiful democratic process. What's also great is usually that there might be a comment period that follows the preliminary decision, where people can review what the ARC talked about and what the FAA has moved forward with. And then you can write public comments on regulation.gov on that specific ruling. And that way, if you have an opinion, it can be heard. And those comments will be sent to the committee kind of making the decision. So I echo the same sentiment, Joe. That gives me a lot of hope. I didn't realize there was an ARC going on for this specific case. And sometimes it's open to public comment period. Sometimes it's not. I don't know if you know if there's going to be a comment period allowed in that process or not. But
as of right now, I don't think there is. I don't know that for certain. But you know, what was interesting about the ARC was, you know, when the Horizon event happened, when the Alaskan flight happened, the NTSB on December 5th announced that they were putting together a safety roundtable. They were calling it the Mental Health Safety Summit, and it was held on December 6th. The exact same day, on December 5th, the FAA announced they were putting together the ARC, right? And then they said, yeah, we're dealing with the two. And then what I thought was a little bit hilarious to look at now was the NTSB then went back on their public notice on their website and said, well, we actually noticed this on November 30th, right? So it was NTSB saying December 5th, FAA saying, yeah, we're doing it also. We're putting together the ARC on December 5th. And then the NTSB came around and said, okay, but we actually did it on the 30th. So it seems like it's kind of a race for everybody to be like, no, we're doing it. It's us. We're doing it.
Well, that's great news.
Great news, right? Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what comes from it.
That's fantastic.
Competition is good for everybody. So now let's, you know, this is all great. You know, maybe this ARC will get together and come up with some really groundbreaking things. But, you know, let's be honest, this kind of is in our, you know, as pilots, we kind of have to do what's right for us.
Yes.
You know, so let's talk about like mental health resources for pilots, you know, particularly those in general aviation or, you know, with limited financial resources, like a student pilot who's listening to this now, who's saying, hey, I really want to be a pilot, but I've got some things that I need to sort out. What kind of accessible mental health do they have, you know, and kind of speak from it from a legal standpoint as well?
So there's a lot of, if you reach out through the forums, everybody knows the forums here, you know, there's a lot of groups that have formed that are just groups of pilots, kind of a lot along the lines of birds of a feather. With HIMSS, that pilots are just talking about mental health issues together, right? And it doesn't go under Box 19 because none of them are providers, right? They're not physicians. They're not technically mental health providers. They're literally just a supportive group, kind of that brotherhood of pilots saying, you know, let's talk about what's going on. And that has been honestly the biggest change that I have seen in the past couple of years. Because it definitely has, it's always had that that stigma of, look, we're not even going to talk about it amongst ourselves, right? We don't know if the FAA is listening, right? So that has changed now, in my opinion. We do have pilots talking about it, and we have groups that are talking about it. And that is honestly the best way for people to at least crack the door open to getting help. As far as formally getting help, that is still a struggle. And I would love to say that that is different. It's not. It is still a struggle right now, which is why we're hoping for the ARC to come out with something. The FAA is so far behind in the review of these conditions and these cases. I think right now, CAMI's sitting at 24,000 cases behind.
Wow.
So even if you were to come out and say, hey, I'm seeing a counselor, I'm seeing a therapist, your medical application would have to get deferred right down to CAMI. CAMI would then throw it over to the FAS, to the Federal Air Surgeon's Office. And honestly, you probably wouldn't get a result or a response in like maybe 5 to 13 months. So I really wish it was better right now, but I'm happy to see that pilots are having open conversations amongst themselves and at least supporting each other pilot to pilot.
You're sitting in that arc, let's say. Let's pretend you get invited to participate. You're at the round table.
Uh-huh.
What are you changing? What things are you going to do from your perspective? What outcomes are good outcomes?
Yeah, so I got asked by a lot of people that are in the ARC. Fortunately, I got the ear of a lot of people in the ARC right now.
Oh, good.
And the number one change that I put forward is we have to change 19. You hit the nail on the head. You guys are right on point. We need to allow pilots to be able to seek counseling, right? They should be able to talk to a counselor. They should be able to talk to a therapist. They should be able to talk to a licensed social worker. Now, if the condition evolves, right, to the point where we're talking about SSRIs, barbiturates, SNRIs, we're talking about psychologists, psychiatrists, absolutely, right? Absolutely. That should be reported. However, I think we're going to see a big positive change in the industry if we start allowing pilots to do that square one, that step one, and address a problem and treat a problem before it becomes something that requires an SSRI or an SNRI or requires formal treatment. I think we're going to see a great shift in this industry.
That's great. Can you speak to how the ARC, what does it cover? Is it just pilots or is it air traffic controllers? Is it flight attendants? Is it mechanics? Is it collectively as an industry, you know, kind of who does that cover? Or are we just talking pilots in this aviation rulemaking committee?
It's technically everything, realistically pilot.
Okay. And you were going to say one more thing. What were you going to add to that?
I said that box 19 is literally if we just take out one sentence.
Really?
Like we're not even talking about writing new rules. You know what I mean? We're literally taking out a sentence in the medical application. And that would have a drastic, drastic effect on this industry.
Let me ask a more ignorant question. I go to see a counselor, I go see a therapist, and I just say, box 19 be damned. Like, okay, I don't really care.
Yeah.
So I go and I report it. Now what?
Okay, so if you report it, more than likely it's getting deferred, which means, you know, obviously the AME is not going to be able to issue the medical that day. You're not walking out with a certificate. Mm-hmm. And they're going to kick it down to CAMI down in Oklahoma City. You're going to get a letter back from CAMI that's going to be issued pursuant to 14 CFR 67.413, 67.413. And it's going to be a request for additional record. And it's going to be a very general request that says a detailed clinical summary from a treating provider regarding your history of mental health, anxiety, whatever, right? Whatever they come up with, it's all the same. They're going to ask for a personal statement and they're going to ask for pharmaceutical records. And then the airman is going to comply with that, send everything down to CAMI. And then it's going to be another 5 months. And then CAMI is going to send another 413 letter. And the 413 letter more than likely is going to say, go see a HIM psychologist or a HIM psychiatrist and get a mental health evaluation. And then the airman will do that. And that'll come back to the FAA. CAMI will review it, realize, oh, this is over our head. And then they're going to throw it to the FAS. And then the Federal Air Surgeon's Office is going to handle it and make a determination from there and then kick the letter back to the pilot. Most likely it's going to be a special issuance under 67-401. And then the pilot's free to move forward, so to speak. But in that timeline, we could be talking anywhere from a year to 2 years.
Wow. That's incredible.
Well, that's such a good piece of information to know, because I know that we have, you know, some pilots who listen to this podcast that have only been in the industry for maybe, you know, 3-5 years, and they might even not even know, you know, I mean, they go through their what do they call it? The Aeromed form, yeah. Right? That you fill out before your medical every year. or every 6 months. And, you know, they might not even know. They might go to therapy and say, oh, yeah, that's no big deal. I just went to therapy because my grandfather passed away. And yeah. And all of a sudden, they're in this administrative process for months on end. So that's such a good piece of information. Know that, you know, you can't go and see a therapist and check the box.
Yeah. And that's what, it's frustrating saying that stuff out loud. You know, I cringe at having to say this stuff. I walk that line of being, you know, people need to know, right? Pilots need to know what that process looks like so they're not surprised when it happens to them.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm telling every single pilot that I talk to, hey, look, if you have an issue, right? If you have a mental health struggle, please, 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 please seek help, right? Like there are people in the industry that advocate for you that we can push you through and get you back flying again. I always use the line, it's a speed bump, not a roadblock, right? Get yourself treated first. The industry is going to be there, right? I know it's a long wait. I know it's a long process, but get treated, right? Before it becomes something that is hard to reverse or hard to control.
Yeah. Before we change topics, Joe, I just wanted to touch on what you said about there being, you know, groups of pilots that are talking about this stuff. So before we move on, how does somebody find one of those groups if they wanted to?
So, you know, Flight Level 350, airlineapps.net, you know, all the major forums, right, that you would go to for that gouge and looking for jobs. I promise you, there are little sub forums and sub chats that talk about exactly this. Very, very accessible. So
excellent.
Joe, you were recently featured in an article on what happened on the American Airlines flight for the unruly passengers. And you said that it was tragic, but it's not uncommon, you know. Let's talk about unruly passengers. I mean, we're kind of shifting gears from the flight deck to the back. I mean, should anybody fly anymore? I mean, this is crazy, yeah. Right? You got the unruly. I'm just joking. I'm just totally joking. Actually, flying is so safe, and you know, this is such a great industry.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, there's been 13 reports for every 10,000 flights of unruly passengers, and that's just from, you know, the three during the last quarter of last year, right? So, and you know, a lot of them were mask related, right? We have to wear the COVID-19 mask and things like that. And yeah, people didn't like that too much. And there was a lot of politicizing around that. But talk to me about, you know, passenger behavior as well.
Yeah, that's since the pandemic, I mean, that has been unreal. I feel like that has not reversed. You know, prior to the pandemic, maybe it's just me, but prior to the pandemic, I never heard of that. I mean, that was such a rare occurrence. You know, you maybe get one video that would pop up and go viral and you think, oh my gosh, what's happening? And then since the pandemic, I mean, during the pandemic, we were getting those videos published on social media like every week. It was wild. And I, you know, we always get the calls from people saying, you know, the flight attendant did this to me, or the pilot did this, or they wouldn't divert, or I got cut off while drinking on the plane. I don't think the public understands that the moment that door closes, you're at the law of the flight crew, right? That flight crew, including the flight attendant, they can do anything within reason and under the interest of aviation safety. And just the audacity of the people in the back trying to overrule the power, the authority of the flight crew was mind-blowing to me, and it still is mind-blowing to me. I wish we could go back to those olden days when, you know, people would dress up for their flights, right? It was, you know, it was like a big event, right? You're about to take an airplane, and it was fantastic because it was this new invention. It's amazing. It's a miracle. In my mind, it's still a miracle. It's still magical, and I don't understand where the respect went for it. So frustrating.
Well, Joe, I want to switch gears back to substance, because we talked about therapy and the fact that pilots, you know, because it's legal, oftentimes will just start drinking and, you know, one thing leads to another. You're exceptionally knowledgeable on the HIMSS program. I want to get into that. And the way that I'm going to do it is by asking a question that I think a lot of pilots would benefit from knowing the answer to is, what happens if I get pulled over and I think I'm on the limit, or I know I'm on the limit? Over the limit. And what do I do? You know, there's a lot of rumors that you should say, you know, don't blow and have them take you to the station.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a couple of ways to attack that. There's a legal side of the house, and then there's the medical side of the house. Mm-hmm. And that's the most frustrating part of certificate defense. A lot of what we do is we're crafting federal air surgeon appeals, we're crafting 413 submissions, and we're crafting them for doctors, not for attorneys, right? So very, very persuasive writing and constantly describing and explaining the regulations and policies and guidelines to these FAA doctors. So right. That's a big question that we get all the time is, what do I do? Am I allowed to refuse? So if you look at 14 CFR 67307.307, which is the exact same language as 67.207, which is the exact same language as 67-107 or .107. That's for first, second, and third class medicals. You'll see in there, if we look at first class, 67.107B has to do with substance abuse. And substance abuse says that it is definable if you refuse a DOT test. So I have pilots all the time say, well, you can't refuse a roadside because that's a DOT test, right? As a pilot, we always have to blow. You always have to accept a test. The legal argument to that is, no, that's not true at all. If we have a state cop, is that state cop really providing a DOT test, right? A highway patrol, if they pull you over, are they providing a DOT test? Do they have the authority to issue a DOT test? Really what that DOT test, if you look at the legislative history of 67107B, that DOT test is in reference to a 119 drug and alcohol test, right? That 135 drivers have to take, that 121 drivers have to take, right? That's really what it's in reference to. So if an airline pilot is walking off last flight of the day and, you know, on the jet bridge, they get the, hey, you're in the drug and alcohol program. We need to get you a quick test here. If an airline pilot were to refuse at that point, that would be immediately deemed substance abuse under 67107B. Now, let's look at it from the doctor's perspective down in CAMI. They're going to say anytime a pilot refuses any test, it's because they're an alcoholic. So I will say it is easier to defend pilots who have complied with the request and who have flown or given blood. It's easier to defend them than it is somebody who has refused.
Interesting.
Because we're already walking back an assumption that that pilot is an alcoholic. Otherwise, there's no reason a pilot would ever refuse.
Interesting. So even if you know, even if you you get pulled over and you know that you're over, just comply, take the test, and get the DUI and then work on it later.
Yeah. And then there's the aspect of, when do you take the test, right? Do you take the test on the side of the road? Is it a refusal then? If you say to them, hey, I'd love to take the test, I'm not refusing, but I'd like to take it back at the station, you know, that provides a little bit of time to metabolize. A lot of agencies will acquiesce on that and they'll be very accommodating of that request. There are some agencies that say, no, if you're not doing it right now, it's a refusal. You know, that's kind of a game time call right in that mix. But obviously, any time that you can allow your body to metabolize, that's going to be more beneficial for your BAC result. So
it's good advice.
Sometimes. I have dealt with pilots, of course, that are on the rise on BAC, and the time delay does not benefit them.
All right. So. That's good to know. All right. So if you end up with a DUI, what's the first, I mean, so we all have hotline number for ALPA, where you can call the union right away. I'm sure APA and SWAPA have similar hotlines. Should everyone have, you know, your number on speed dial? Who should they be calling if this happens?
Yes, yeah, so two different avenues. So you have the FAA medical side of the house, and then you have the SAP, right? The SAP program for the employer. Please know those are not the same. So I've seen cases where pilots have fought to get their medical back only to find out that they are not hireable because they never went through a SAP and never got a SAP clearance to come back to work. So please know that there's SAP as well as the medical side of the house. I don't do anything with SAP. I handle the medical side of the house. It is important. It is helpful to get an aviation attorney on board immediately to start working with a criminal attorney, because there are times that a criminal attorney will do things to try and best influence the criminal case, but at the same time, that action negatively impacts the medical case down the road for me. So it is always helpful.
How so?
So the biggest one that we see is evaluation. They'll go and do like a SASE, a substance abuse evaluation that is performed by a licensed clinical social worker. And a lot of times, especially on the SASE will say it doesn't have an option for no alcohol condition, right? So the lowest thing on the list is substance use disorder mild. So the FAA will take that and be like, alcoholic, right? And so, but you know, in the criminal world, that is a very good result, right? In a criminal world, the criminal attorney could say, look, substance use disorder mild, right? And that may, you know, help them on the probation or on the resolution of the case, or, you know, the general disposition of the case. But in my world, I'm like, oh my gosh, now I got to deal with this, right? And I got to walk this back. So it's nice when we get to work with a criminal attorney and we get to say, no, please don't do that. There are also times when the, my idea of a good case is better than a criminal attorney's idea of a good case. So if I have an airman that is blowing like a 0.24, something like that, it benefits my world if, you know, the cop opens the door to the truck and beer cans fall out and the pilot gets out and tries to punch a cop, right? That's
not
more
good.
Beneficial in my world than the aviation world. And I'm sure a criminal attorney listening to this is probably cringing going, oh my God, I don't want that case. So it's definitely, it's nice when we get to work together with each other and kind of find a middle ground. So
that makes a lot of sense. So someone ends up in HIMSS. Can you tell us a little bit for people who aren't very familiar with it? And I know a lot of people might think, you know, that's for somebody else. It's not for me, but I think there's a good reason for everyone to be generally familiar with the program, what it looks like and benefits and drawbacks, if there are any benefits.
HIMSS is a tragedy. I'm sorry. I'm going to be very blunt with this. So please excuse my candor with HIMSS. Again, as mentioned earlier, I started my career by putting pilots into the HIMSS program. So the HIMSS program is a program that was developed in the 70s by ALPA. And it was developed to basically treat pilots that were dealing with alcohol issues, right? So back in those days, it was 30 days of rehab, 30 days of outpatient monitoring, and then 30 days of just kind of general follow-up. And then you were back in the cockpit in 90 days. Super successful program. It was only available to 121 drivers. So when I started my career representing 91 drivers, what I would do is I would basically make a HIMSS program for a general 91 driver who maybe had two DUIs. And I would tell the FAA, look, under 67401, under the special issuance, these are your criteria. I'm basically mimicking the 121 HIMSS program. Can you let this airman still fly rather than just denying the medical and saying, nope, no such luck? And it was very successful back then. It was, we got to pick our own doctors. We got to work a good program. It was very clinically and medically focused. Over the years, I have watched the deterioration of the program, and the program has deteriorated away from a clinically based program to one of control and compliance. It is now available to everybody. It's the gold standard, except the only people that get it paid for are 121 drivers. 91 and 135 drivers still have to pay for their own HIMSS program. They're expected to go through it, but they have to pay for it. Year number one is like anywhere from $35,000 to $60,000 out of pocket. The program it's very obtuse. It's very objective. You know, there are set criteria. Like, for example, an airline pilot, a 121 driver who gets four DUIs, and the last one, there's a loaded gun in the car, right? Like, and catches a gun charge at it too. That pilot will get the exact same HIMSS program as somebody who's had a DUI 10 years ago. There is no subjectivity. There's no case-by-case evaluation. There's no clinical evaluation anymore. And that's very frustrating. That just got highlighted. I'm going to throw this out there so it just doesn't sound like I'm on an angry rampage. So this last year, 2023, was the 50th anniversary of the HIMSS program. And Congress said to the FAA, how's it going? We've been paying for this program for 50 years. Do you have any data? Do you have any reports, any studies to say that we've been paying for a good thing? It's been improving the industry. And the FAA said, no, we don't keep data. We don't keep any studies on it. And Congress said, well, you better find some, because when your reauthorization comes around, we're going to remember that you don't have any, and essentially stop funding the HIMSS program. So the FAA went out and paid the National Academy of Sciences back in April of 23, paid them $1 million to run a third-party independent review of the HIMSS program. It got published September 8th of last year, and it was 560-some pages of greatness, just dragging the program through the mud. Everything that I just said, no objective, everything was objective, no subjective review, no case-by-case evaluation, using antiquated medical standards, no real aeromedical input into the HIMSS program. And it is a program, that study, the NAS study, is publicly available. And the FAA is doing a great job of sweeping that thing under the rug, because not a lot of pilots know it exists. So definitely go Google that one. That's a good read.
Very interesting. Well, and you specialize on getting people out of the HIMSS program, right? So how do you do that? And if someone's in the program and they want to try to get out, what chances do they have of potentially getting out of it?
So back in the day, HIMSS was 30 days. Then HIMSS got pushed to 3 years, and then HIMSS got pushed to 5 years. So you would do 5 years of SI monitoring. I wish I was making this up, but April 1 of COVID, April Fool's Day, 2020, the FAA published a policy that said HIMSS is now lifetime.
Wow.
And then very quickly after they published that, you know, ALPA lost their mind. The FAA walked it back and did the step down plan, right? The step down program says that you have 7 years transitioning through different levels of the HIMSS program till eventually year seven, you're just seeing a HIMSS AME and you're monitoring through. The step down plan has not gone well. It used to be up to CAMI. Dr. Dumsdorf was the one who would approve a step down. He got overwhelmed. There were way too many step down requests coming in. And he basically threw up his hands and said, we're not doing that anymore. An AME can now do a step down without asking CAMI for approval. However, an AME cannot step down an airman early. An AME has to step down according to the step down plan, doing all the year segments all the way through 7 years. So right now, the only way to really press on the HIMSS program is by, you know, federal air surgeon appeals, followed by a congressional inquiry, most likely through a senator. And then, of course, we have the nuclear option of suing the FAA under their policies being arbitrary and capricious, being objective and not having any case-by-case evaluation to get an airman out of that program.
Wow. Have you ever had success in suing the FAA?
So the arbitrary and capricious program or a lawsuit is a little unfortunate in the fact that a success means it gets kicked back to the FAA. And basically, the Court of Appeals of District Columbia says, hey, FAA, what you did was arbitrary and capricious. Try again.
Wow. Okay.
And then the FAA just gets to do it again.
Interesting.
So it's a very, very frustrating program. And I am very happy that on the reauthorization that went through the House, I think on September 21st of last year, now going to the Senate, there is a section in there that the FAA has to revisit and modernize the HIMSS program.
Understood.
Which would probably end up in an ARC, right? An Aviation Rulemaking Committee, potentially, if it gets through. Yeah.
Yeah. It says that that within 180 days of the reauthorization going through, that they have to set up an ARC and they have to revisit all the policies and guidelines concerning HIMSS.
Well, it sounds like positive progress being made. Ryan, I know you're probably dying to jump in here, but staying on the thread of actionable advice for pilots, can we at least touch on, you know, cardio issues or something like that where if a pilot goes in for their medical and it gets denied, what do they do? What should they do? Can we touch on that?
Yeah. So yeah, cardio issues are a pain. The FAA doesn't have a cardiologist in-house. So the FAA has to do what's called the cardiac panel. And they basically reach out to two doctors nationwide and say, hey, will you please review this stack of applications? It is important to, if you get deferred for cardio issues, it's important to reach out to anybody to advocate for you because it's very easy to get in this back and forth with the FAA where they're requesting, you know, now they're requesting a Bruce protocol stress test. Now they're requesting a Holter 24-hour monitor. Now they're requesting an angio. Now they're requesting imagery from that angio. You know, it's very easy to get 413 lettered to death. So it's very helpful right at the start to get somebody to advocate for you and say, hey, look, these are all the tests that you need to do. I'm so sorry that you need to do them, but these are all the tests you need to do so that you can go through that cardiac panel a little bit more smoothly. And what's frustrating is we've been finding nationwide that there's a lot of cardiologists that are like, yeah, I'm not going to do that order. I'm not putting in that order. Like, why would you have to do a nuclear stress test for that? So it's helpful to be in contact with cardiologists that are willing to write those tests, not because they're clinically or medically necessary, but because they're regulatorily or administratively necessary. So yeah, that process is frustrating. The fact that the FAA is not prepared to handle those cases and really has never been prepared to handle those cases.
That's great.
Ryan?
I'm going to switch gears one more time real quick. Let's talk about those that are aspiring to get into aviation law. Talk about your business a little bit. Talk about how you make money, some of the ups and the downs that you have, you know, kind of, you know, let's talk about that side of things.
Sure. So three big ways, you know, back when I went to law school, there was one law school in the country that provided any education surrounding aviation, and it was SMU. And SMU had a one semester course on aviation transactions. So nowadays, though, there are so many schools that focus on aviation. And the big one is space law now, right? There's a bunch of schools that have space law theory classes. That's blowing up. But practically right now, the moneymakers within the industry are you're either doing transactions, you're doing certificate defense, or you're doing crash litigation. So here at Ramos, we have an entire certificate defense division, and we represent pilots from Puerto Rico to Alaska, having to do with medical issues and FAA enforcement issues. And then we also have a litigation team. And the litigation team focuses on crashes. And we do that all over the world. We have clients all over the world having to do with that type of space. At the moment, we don't do a lot in transactions. It's just, you know, it's not the speed that I like, right? Going through just a big stack of paperwork and then drafting another big stack of paperwork. It's not super fun for me. But those are the two business focuses that we have within the Ramos Aviation division itself. So kind of two different pillars.
That's interesting. And is there any opportunity for airline pilots to maybe get a side gig or do some consulting with you guys? You know, that's something that I did for many, many years. Is I was an aviation consultant and kind of did some contract work that indirectly for the FAA. Talk to me about that, those opportunities.
Yeah, 100%. So we do have law clerks, you know, people that are in law school right now that are looking for real world experience within the industry. We certainly take law students, internships, externships, all that good stuff. Go figure, a lot of them are airline pilots. They're Part 121 pilots who are looking for that side hustle, right? That side gig. And a lot of them go to law school at night and then look to kind of get into this industry. We also have a lot of experts. You know, a lot of what we do, especially in the crash litigation world, as we all know, the NTSB loves the phrase pilot air, right? Control flight into terrain. A lot of stuff surrounding just pure piloting, right? And so oftentimes we'll reach out to experts within the industry or those, you know, that have that real world experience, maybe on that aircraft type or in that type of flying. And we'll do exactly what you're talking about. We'll hire them for consulting and guidance as we work through a case. You know, where should we be looking? Where are the bodies hidden type situation, right? Same thing with, funny enough, human factors, right? You know, pilots are trained a lot in human factors, CRM, risk analysis, all that. We use a lot of contractors in that space as well. So yeah, it's always nice to see people from the industry kind of cross back and forth here within the legal spectrum of the industry.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting. You know, when I wanted to get into aviation, it was like, be a pilot, right? And you go to training and you do all that and you get to the airlines and then you're like, holy cow, like there's actually like a ton that you can do outside of just flying an airplane that's contributory to aviation. And you can be around aviation without actually, you know, flying an airplane. And I thought those kinds of jobs, you know, just for those thinking about getting into a career in aviation or already in aviation and want to, like you said, do that little moonlight, which the airline world kind of enables you to do. There's a lot. And, you know, the skills and the experience and the knowledge that you attain as an airline pilot can be applicable to a lot of scenarios and really be helpful to the industry. So pretty neat. Joe, I want to end on a light note. Out of all the guests we've had, nobody's had better hair than me. We got to have a laugh after all that, right? I mean, him's
cardiovascular. And that's a call to go check us out on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. Go look at our YouTube channel. I mean, we got to hear about the hair, man. The how you style it and all that. So no, I'm just joking.
It comes up all the time. You'd be surprised on like Reddit AMAs and stuff. It's like the number one comment is, what's that product? So yeah, my hairstylist loves it. I always send her all those comments.
That's hilarious.
You should do like an outtake reel of like everybody saying it on all your things. Joe, you know, I want to be respectful of your time. Really appreciate you coming on the show. For those pilots that are seeking advice or consultation from your firm, how do folks get in touch with you? Or how do they stay in touch or how do they follow you?
Yeah, so we're on every platform, Ramos Law Aviation, and just Ramos Law is on every platform, Facebook, Instagram. I think there's even a TikTok, LinkedIn. The only social media I have is LinkedIn, and I'll be very honest with you, I use it to troll the FAA. So feel free to follow me on LinkedIn. There's always fun comments under the FAA's aeromedical posts.
Is that under Joseph LaRusso on
LinkedIn? It is, yep. It's okay. Under Joseph LaRusso. It's at least a laugh. I don't know who does their social media, but amazing. Some of the stuff that they post is just like, yeah, what are you guys thinking?
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to check it out for sure. Joe, thank you so much for coming on, and thanks for listeners for tuning in.
Thank you guys amazing. So much. Pleasure.
Catch you on the next one.
Thanks.